I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street.
Call us anytime during the show, toll free, 888-429-5471.
Not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone.
As America's schools are focusing more on social justice than equal justice, are our children being indoctrinated to accept the failed entitlement philosophies that have led to the financial crisis in Europe? Will our kids be doomed to live in an over-regulated welfare state? Our guest author and veteran John Vanderburg lived through the Nazi occupation in Holland, understands the unique economic opportunities that America offers those who are willing to work for success. And he's here with us tonight. His new book is From Tyranny to Freedom. And let's see, John, I welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here. You know, as a matter of fact, if we look at the economy right now, and if we look at America as it stands right now, and we go back to Germany right before the Second World War, before it became Nazi Germany, I think we see many of the same things. I think we see government nationalizing the school system, government nationalizing the auto industry, the banking industry, and so on and so forth. Do you see similarities of what we are going through now as when you were a kid going through that that world in Holland?
Absolutely. There are a lot of similarities. The situation is really frightening as far as I'm concerned. Some people ask me, what does your experience of World War II, how does it compare to what's going on in the world today? And, you know, Hitler wanted to kill Jews, Christians, and take over the world. And today the Islamic jihadists, the fanatics, they also want to kill Christians, Jews, and take over the world. And in the process, the government is leaning towards socialism, and which was prominent in World War II, and that led to fanaticism and fascism and eventually communism. So this is a dangerous trend, and I'm very concerned about it.
My concern also, and I'm concerned as the same type of concern that you have. You know, I was born in America in the very early 40s, and I've lived my life here, and I've seen a tremendous amount of changes go on. Never have I seen it this socialistic before. Never have I seen it to a point whereby, you're right, it's moving to fanaticism. You know, you take these kids, well, not kids, you take the people who are demonstrating against Wall Street, you're seeing more and more violence in the street, you're seeing more and more separation. You know, you got this one against that one, men against women, women against women, the left against the right. I mean, it goes on and on here. And if something doesn't happen pretty soon, we are going to be just like it was in Holland and Germany and many of those countries during pre-Second World War and during the Second World War.
You know, Nazi Germany was, before the war, was really a nice country, a lot of educated, cultural people, but the youth was indoctrinated in the schools in various ways towards that socialism that Hitler promoted, and it's a bad trend, and it's good to recognize that that's what's happening today. I was just glad to survive World War II with my family, and war is just a horrible experience, and the demonic forces that cause people to do such crazy things like the Holocaust is just incredible, and it really happened. And I saw it in my own town, and people were taken away, Jewish people especially, were taken away at night at gunpoint. Totally innocent people were taken away from our neighborhood and taken off to Germany to concentration camps or where else they went. It's just a horrible thing.
But that, see, that's what's happening, John. That's what's happening today. We are pointing fingers. We are blaming people. People aren't being taken out of their homes, you know, thank goodness. But at the same time, we're blaming. And we're getting to a point now where everybody's frightened to death to say anything, because if you say something, you can get sued for it. And
yeah,
it's getting to the point where you can't say, what did I hear today? Something that was going on in the news. I heard it in the background. I can't remember what high school it is. But there was a basketball game, and there was a certain segment of the of the students chanting, USA, USA, USA. Well, they stopped it. And the reason they stopped it was because they thought it was racial and it was against the Hispanic element of the community. I mean, I don't even understand this anymore. If it's an Hispanic unit, if it was against the Hispanics, then why weren't they yelling Caucasian, Caucasian, Caucasian instead of USA, USA, USA? See, we're getting to a point now where we've got our country labeled as the bad guy.
Well, that's ridiculous, and people just don't understand world history, and I've lived through it, and to see at the end of the war, to see American soldiers to bring us freedom, they came in tanks and trucks right in front of our apartment building, and on the last day of the war, and they were waving and smiling at us, which was an incredible sight for me, because I'd seen a lot of soldiers in green uniforms, but they never smiled or waved at us. They were nasty and mean, and they killed people and took them away. But these people in these tanks and trucks, they were different. And it was just like a positive culture shock for me. And after the war, I remember vividly, I think God put a strong desire in the back of my head. I had to go see that country where these people came from that brought us freedom.
Yeah.
And I did, and somehow I made it to America, and worked on ships and everything, because I wanted to see this country that brought freedom to people, and I don't see Al Qaeda and fanatic Islamic people bring freedom to anybody. They're just nasty, and they just want to kill people, and it's just a big difference.
Sure, when you come down to it, and they have seen. And I'm sure you've seen it also or heard about it recently. I think it was it in Iran. There is a young man who happens to be a Christian pastor. They want to kill him because he's not going to change, to the religion of the day, quote unquote, as far as it goes. You know, and we're getting people beheaded. We're getting people killed. And if a Quran is accidentally destroyed, or it's destroyed so it doesn't cause any problems, you got, what, 5 or 6 Americans that are killed out there. They've got the demonstrations going on. Something is wrong somewhere. We've gotten to a point where we're apologizing for ourselves, and as long as we do that, we've lost our strength. One of the reasons they were afraid of us at one time, and if you're afraid of us, you don't do things that's going to cause death, destruction to the people that we're trying to protect.
And you know how many Christian churches and Bibles have been destroyed and burned by Islamic fanatics in different countries, including Egypt. And we don't go and complain and start demonstrations against Islam.
No.
But when they do, or they sure take it out on us and think that we are just terrible people. And the truth lies on the opposite side. We are tolerant, we are loving, and we forgive, and we try to get along. And we try to help people. And I was amazed last week with these terrible tornadoes in the Midwest, how many people came from great distances to help the people. And I didn't see any Muslims. I didn't see any Al-Qaeda people, terrorists, saying, oh, we want to help you. they don't know that.
And I think what it really comes down to is this. I happen to be Jewish, and I was brought up in this country. I didn't do anything to anybody, so quote-unquote, why hate me? And there's a tremendous amount of hate out there, and all I did was get born, and I go about my business, and I'm an American, and I am so American, I squeak over here. But that's where the point is. We point fingers, and we say it's them, it's because of them. And when it really comes down to it, it's people that are controlling the mindset of someone else to accomplish their goals and their ideologies.
Yes. I put in my book that I'm pro-Semitic. And you know, there's so much anti...
Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you.
And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Call us toll-free, 888-429-5471. That's 888-429-5471. Join us anytime you want. Now, our guest at the age of 8 years old, Maxim Starchenko, was selected by Ivan Prilipov to be a member of his soccer or hockey team, the Druzhba 78 in the Ukraine. The initial excitement and hopes of eventually representing his country led to a world of, listen to the words, cruelty and abuse. And for 10 years, he and his teammates endured unspeakable torment, and Pravlov built his reputation. But at 18 years old, Maxim broke his allegiance and took life into his own hands. He is now the author of Behind the Iron Curtain, Tears in the Perfect Hockey Gulag. And let us say, Maxim, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you.
But, by the way, thank you so much for here. Did I stumble over the words? I tried saying Druzhba. Is that the right way to say it?
Yes, that's correct, Druzhba. But that, in Russian, actually, or Ukrainian, it means friendship.
Ah, okay. Well, that was everything opposite of what happened to you. Let's go to the heart of this. What caused you to write the book in the first place? What's the core message? What is inside this book that people need to hear?
Where do I start, though? but the most important thing, kind of, I came to understanding that I was at peace with my own life.
Yeah.
And I got married, fell in love, and the girl that I married beforehand, I explained to her who I was. I basically opened up to her completely, and wanted her to accept me the way I was and with all my past. And she did. And over time, I kind of came to be very complacent with my life. Not complacent, but happy with my life, and yeah. Thought that now that I'm not angry, I can actually write this story.
But let's go back, Maxim. Let's go back. Let's go back. You're 8 years old, and you're excited. You're going to become, going to become a hockey player. But what did you get into? The soccer hockey team. But what is it that you got into that you weren't expecting? When we talk about, the cruelty and abuse. We know that athletics, and I was an athlete years and years ago, that you go through some really tough, hard times. But what was it about this particular coach? What did he do that brought it beyond the
It went on every single, imaginable and unimaginable level. At first, it started just the physical abuse. After about a couple months that I was with him, I mean, everything was good. My parents loved him. I loved him because he was a fanatic about sports. He was fanatic, and he was devoted 100% to it. Yeah. But what I couldn't see at first is how far he was taking this fanaticism. And in my book, for example, compared him to Hitler or Stalin, because the level of fanaticism he showed was just incomparable to probably many coaches out there. But anyway, what I'm saying is that after about a couple of months, he started with the physical abuse, and he would just use a hockey stick to basically hit us, beat us. Once in a while, he would break a bone there and there. I would end up with a cast on my arm or something like this. But after a while, it became more than that. He began using mental abuse, like basically harassing you in public, telling you how ugly you are or something like this. Or once in a while, he would just tell you about all the abnormalities that you have, physical, emotional, mental, whatever that was, and basically have a have a fun with it. Of course, every player on my team kind of, I wouldn't say every player at first. Most of the players were enduring something like this. But there were a few players who endured the most. I guess at the beginning I was one of them.
Let me hold you up for a second. Let me hold you up for a minute. What kind of a guy was he? I mean, when, you know, obviously he did the abuse. He did it physically. He did it mentally. He did it emotionally. But what drove him? Did you ever experience? Did you ever find out what drove him to be like this?
I think he was a psychopath. He could never have friends. That's one of the things that I can tell you for sure. Never really had any friends. And he used us, he called us his children. But I think we were his sort of somebody that he could at least be with or have some kind of control over.
Yeah.
I personally believe that he probably just wanted to have a control over anything that he had in life, and children were the easiest to control.
What caused you to stay? What was the compelling reason? Was it being on the team?
He must have had some kind of abuse when he was younger, because he never spoke about his childhood. He never spoke. He only spoke about the fact that other kids used to laugh at him. He was probably bullied a lot when he was little, because he himself not a big guy.
Maxim, let me hold you up. Let me ask you this: what was the compelling reason? What caused you to stay? What caused the other teammates to stay? I mean, you know, you got people being beaten up. You got them physically, emotionally, intellectually abused, embarrassed in public. What caused you to stay with it for all those years?
Because I didn't know any better. You know how you live in certain condition, and
sure.
You sort of you don't know any better. You just go through that condition. You don't realize that there's something better maybe out there, or this is just completely wrong. Although I understood that it was wrong, I still lived through it. Another compelling, I think, reason because of just like I told you, the culture, but. Like my parents, my dad was also pretty strict on me all the time, and he was very similar in terms of how he approached mentally toward my mistakes, toward my life. Basically, you know, be a man, stand up for yourself. If you got in trouble, take it like a man and live through it. Don't complain about it, things like that.
Yeah.
That type of mentality probably made me just go through it, take it like a man, and basically feel good that you have lived through it and you survived. Something in that.
Sure. No, but let me ask you this. Do you today, not to the degree that you were put through it and your teammates were put through, but do we have that thing going on today? Do we have something similar with kids? Are kids controlled by coaches? Not all coaches, but in similar circumstances, does that go on around the world still?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I personally think it's going on even on greater level than we think, because look at the recent Penn State incident. There's also, I believe, Syracuse incident also.
Yeah.
I mean, these are just the big cases, especially Penn State. Just recently broke out that Sandusky was accused of sexually abusing at the college level, so many players, basically for his own benefit.
By the way, did Ivan sexually abuse any of the players?
I personally think he did.
Okay.
With my own eyes, I saw how he, first of all, he sort of like mentally abused them. There were several players on the team that he literally accused of being, I'm going to use word, faggots.
Yeah.
He was accusing them, and he made them in front of the team, basically kind of act out being the faggot. Or he would tell them, tell all the boys, what would you like to do to them? Things like that. But it had gotten to, I think, a greater degree of abuse when we would be in the locker room, let's say, for example.
Yeah.
And in our locker room, we had a small room with a door where it's like a coach's room.
Yeah.
And he would be in there. And once in a while, we would have players go in there. He would talk one-on-one to us. And one time he did that, and several players who he actually accused of being faggots, they would be in there for a long time.
Yeah.
Who knew what was going on in there? But in my book, let's say, I wrote a couple incidences when he made one of the players masturbate in front of the entire team. And then another incident when I'm not sure what happened in the locker room, but he was so happy about this. Ivan was not sort of happy, but I would say ecstatic about this, probably, because when we got in the locker room after a certain practice, he wasn't at the practice. He was in the locker room with a certain player.
Yeah. And, now, let me ask this. Let me fast forward you here. Now, he got arrested this last January. What did he get arrested for? Did it have anything to do with those allegations, the way he treated his team?
Mm-hmm. Yep. There were two boys, apparently, and he took them over the state border. That's why the feds arrested him. So he took those boys over the state border, and he took them. And I 100% I believe that story, because I stayed at his house so many times. My teammates stayed so many times at his house. He always had boys over at his apartment, over at his house. I mean, so, all the time. And it sort of like became a norm. And when here, he just took those boys and probably forced one of the boys to whatever he forced them to do sexually.
Yeah.
And the other boy witnessed the entire thing.
Now, by the way, this was going on. This was going on for many, many years. If this had been going on for a year or so, that's one thing. But it's been going on many, many years now. No, he committed suicide in February. He committed suicide. Do you think that the suicide was because of his final exposure to the public for the things that he was doing?
Yes, I personally believe that. But I also there's several things. First of all, we all know what happens to those who get in jail for things that he did. And he didn't want to probably go through that. That's one. And second of all, he never said, I'm sorry or apologized for anything that he did to me. Not once in entire life. And he always felt righteous about what he did to us. He felt like he was educating us, or not only educating, but I think like he was reforming us, making us better as people. I don't know how that fits his mentality, but in my case, it's completely wrong. But anyway, he was just afraid to go through something like this, to go through abuse himself, but he also never said I'm sorry, and he never wanted to kneel before anyone to be basically experience the public sort of like a judgment, let's put it that way.
Yeah, no, absolutely no question about it. But you know, it almost sounds like it was the old gladiator training in Rome, that except you guys, well, maybe you were prisoners when it really comes down to it. But and if this happens today, maybe more and more it should be put out to the public. I do believe athletes that need a discipline, and an athlete needs to be stronger than anybody else out there because of what you put up with. But there comes that point where the line gets crossed, and all of the things that he was doing was way above and beyond the call. How do you help kids? How do you get regulations in? How do you control it at the same time, still allow them to go out and be everything they can be out in the field?
I think the prevention probably is the best cure for that. Prevention. By prevention, I mean educating parents. I personally think that there are a lot of parents who close their eyes on this, and they believe nothing happens like this. These are just isolated cases and everything. But I personally know myself how easy it is to manipulate the child's mind. It's so easy, believe me, and because children, basically, they don't have much experience in life. They are naive in their mind, and they want to please grown-ups. That's for the most part. And what happens is this, when cases like this arise, basically children kind of go along. They know it's wrong, but they sort of go along with it. Like, for example, Sheldon Kennedy, he was the National Hockey League player in Canada, and he came out in 1997, told his story, and all of a sudden, just the ball started rolling. He organized an education program over there for parents and for basically coaches, parents, anybody who wants to do it, in order to just to basically look at the symptoms, how to detect those symptoms, all aspects of it. He only took a perspective. I think he only took perspective from the sexual abuse. In my case, it was every abuse possible. It's sexual, every abuse. Just to look for symptoms, because I ran away from home 2 times. I wanted to quit so many times. Personally, I wanted to commit suicide so many times. And my parents sort of continued to push me back. Just lately, I spoke with my parents in April of 2011. I wrote my book, and I was just about to publish my book, and I went home to tell my parents about everything that happened because they had no clue. Yeah. And I spoke to them, and my mom was dumbfounded. My dad just listened to a couple of stories and left the room because he had enough. It was, yeah, for him, it was way too much. And for my mom, she just sat there dumbfounded, and she told me that all those years that when I would run away from home, that I always, she thought that it was her, sort of she would take everything upon herself. She never even realized that Ivan was the cause of everything. And I never told them because, and she asked me, why didn't you never told me? I told her that this is something that children don't talk about. We just take it within us. It's sort of, and it's really tough to even explain that. Why?
Max, let me hold you up for a minute. We're starting to run out of time, but there's a question I do want to ask that could be to get right down to the bottom of this. The International Ice Hockey Federation. Now, do they make money in the sport?
Yes, they do.
Okay. And there are many places that did not intervene, that could have intervened. Was money a part of people not creating the regulations, people not worrying about what was happening to the kids? Did money have a part in this?
In this case, I don't think there was much. I don't think it's the money case. I don't think anybody paid anybody. It was just the fact that.
Let me hold you up. I don't mean anybody paying anybody. Mm-hmm. What I mean is International, the Hockey Federation, the different places whereby the different places where they would make money having the teams play. This is what I'm talking about. The organizations, okay, etc. That's what I mean. They don't want to look because you know it stops income coming in from their to their pockets.
They would still have enough money. It's the International Ice Hockey Federation is a very, it's like, so like a grand organization. They get money from all international tournaments. Teams pay them all the time, basically for participation. And, of course, they participate in tournaments and all this, and they run it. They were supposed to be the governing body of the entire hockey thing on the globe, basically. They were contacted several times. I know by myself a couple times. There are other parents I know throughout several years, many years before, they would contact and they would say, don't talk to us, talk to the local association. Well, yeah, the local association didn't really do much about it because they didn't want to get the information out. That's my personal opinion. They just didn't want to get the information out. It sort of like they would say it would hurt the sport. and parents would think this is kind of sports where, you know, only I'm going to use the word pedophiles and abusers coaching our kids. That's not the case. And for the majority part, it's not the case. But there are so many instances where kids are just quiet about it and don't say much about it, and things like that do happen. Money-wise,
Maxim, we're just about out of time. Do you have a website where we can find you at and buy the book and find out more?
Yeah, oh, yeah, definitely. The well, it's on my publisher's website is the books, Dorrance Pub. No, what's the, let me see, hold on a second.
We've got it up on our website just in case
Rose
anybody
Dog
misses
Bookstore. Here we go. RoseDogBookstore.com on publisher's site, and then Amazon.com. Barnes & Noble also, and they're actually right now, I know that there are quite a few websites right now sell my book and ebook version as well.
Wonderful. Maxim, we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for joining us, and that's a message that you do have to get out there.
Uh-huh. Thank you very much.
Take care. Good night.
Okay. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Walter Yukon Yates with us. He's been a Marine, gold prospector, pilot, airport builder, adventurer, helicopter crash survivor, and an entrepreneur throughout his entire life. He's got a documentary. It's called Breakaway. It was made several years ago. It's about several years of his life. And the title is an autobiography. Sometimes in life, everyone just gets the urge to break away. Walter, hi. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Mike.
Hey, thank you so much for being here. Let me ask you this. Alaska. What was the allure to about Alaska for you?
Wow. I tell you what about Alaska. I started out quite young reading stories about Alaska, like The Call of the Wild and stuff like that Jack London wrote. And I just vowed I wanted to do it, and that's what called me.
Now, by the way, it's a very interesting place in his technological and as civilized as the world is getting, there's still parts of Alaska that effectively are always going to be by themselves and completely away from everything and not touched by the world. Now, for you with Alaska, where were you in Alaska? Where were the adventures?
Most of my adventures were located about 200 miles west of Anchorage in the Kuskokwim Mountains,
yep,
and on the Post River. And that's where I built a cabin and stayed there and lived alone, lived off the land for a year, and really felt that I was part of the people that used to do this. You know, this country was settled by people who didn't have anything but jackrabbits and Indians when they got here.
Absolutely.
And look what we made of it.
I got it loud and clear. I spent 20-some-odd years in the interior of Alaska. Been there, done that, been down the Yukon River where there was just nobody out there but wolves. And as you're going down a river, there's bears running up and down the beach part. And it's a place that there's still parts of Alaska the civilization has not gotten to yet.
That's exactly right. I'll tell you, I was so deep into the wilderness, I think any direction I would go, I would be coming out.
Yeah. Now, got it loud and clear. Now, by the way. Yeah, I'm reading your bio, Semper Fi.
Well, Semper Fi back to you.
You bet. Okay. Of course, I was in a lot. I was in later than you were, but I was there. By the way, now the tales of exploring Alaska. What was it that for you personally to get out there by yourself, to live the way you lived, to experience life the way people lived it 200 years ago? What was that thing that, what was it that was satisfied way deep within you about all of this?
Well, I think the greatest satisfaction I got out of it was that I still can do it. I did what these people did when they first settled here. And I think that was probably my most gratifying experience of everything I did, other than the period of time I had my helicopter up there. And I flew around and explored old ghost towns and abandoned mines. And I just had a wonderful time.
Well, I bet you did. You know, there's a lot of people who will never understand the real value of an outhouse.
No, where you have to carry the seat into the cabin, because if you take it out, leave it outside, you're going to freeze to it.
At about 40 degrees below zero, it's still fun. There are certain things you just got to get done. Now, I really believe when it really comes down to it, there are people who talk about the cold, but unless you've been in 40, 50 below zero and experienced what it's like, you know, people will never know, and it's something that once you've done it, and it's something to talk about. Now, let's go back to the log cabin in Alaska. Now, log cabin is just, that's what it is. It's a log cabin. It's shelter. No electricity, no running water. That's when you're getting to the outhouse. You know, and there are many people who that would prefer actually living like that today without all this insanity that we have in civilization.
I don't doubt but what that's true.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Now, what was one of your most memorable stories? What is the one thing in your life with all of your travels that stood out for you?
Well, I would have to say it's when I crashed my helicopter in British Columbia. And I had a broken back and 7 broken ribs and laid there beside the wreckage for 14 days before they found me.
Ow.
That will forever be in my mind.
Yeah. And if you were out there, you were also exposed to the wilderness. You were exposed to wolf, bears, whatever it is that's out there. So you're really lucky. You know, someone was watching over you in that one.
I don't doubt that.
Yeah. Yeah. And by the way, you know what I find? You know, I've been back and forth in Texas. I haven't been there a lot. I've been there a few times. But one of the things that I found that, you know, a lot of Texans are just like Alaskans. There's a bond there, and I don't even know what it is.
Well, you know that I ran into a large amount of people from Texas that had gone to Alaska. So
yeah.
Who knows? Maybe a large percentage of them are from Texas.
Yeah. There's
lots of Texans.
Yeah, no, there's a mindset. And I remember when I went through boot camp. I went through boot camp in 1960. But I remember going through boot camp, MCRD, San Diego. And everybody that I went through boot camp with, they were all from Texas, Port Arthur, Orange, and that area. So even though that I haven't spent a lot of time in Texas, for some reason I always end up around Texans.
Well, there's a lot of us.
There's good stuff. Now, by the way, if you had had anything in your life to change, what would it be? Or would you just leave it exactly the way it was?
I don't see where I could change a thing. I just think I've led a good life. I've had my my problems and episodes of trouble and trials and tribulations, but you know, the memories of it all is worth it.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Now, by the way, you filmed Breakaway, the documentary. Where do we find the film?
Yes, I surely did. That was the year I spent up there alone, and I made a 90-minute documentary, which, by the way, I got an award in Hollywood for an outstanding documentary.
Wow. Now, by the way, how does somebody find the documentary?
Well, they can get the documentary through me on my website, UConnYates.com. We'll get that movie, as well as if they're interested in my book, and anybody interested in seeing what really early America was like ought to read my book.
One of the things that stands out, and I know you talk about this, and we can touch on it, the hardest part of living in Alaska's dark winters in a log cabin. It's not so much the winters are dark, the winters are long, and daylight is long. And I can remember, I don't know how many times, it was 11 o'clock before the sun came up, and it was about 1:30 in the afternoon before it went down. And if you're going to get used to the dark, you go to Alaska.
You have to get used to the dark, because most of the time that's what you're going to have. Even in the dead of winter, it's just dark.
Yeah. No, I got it loud and clear. Now, the other side of that, with those good few months of summer, it's almost daylight 24 hours a day. So that's a very interesting thing to get used to. It's either all light or it's all dark, one way or the other. Now, the people...
Well, you're right.
The people that you ran into there, the one thing I found which was very interesting, the people who, you know, lived out at the villages and whatever, they live a completely different life than somebody, you know, down south in the United States here lives, because it's the conversation. You say something and it takes them about a minute or two to respond. There's nobody's in a hurry because there's nothing to rush to. And that is a completely different mindset and a way of life most people would have no idea that exists.
Well, I can certainly see that you've been there and done that. That's the way they are.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
You know, the outstanding part of my experience is these things that I did all this alone. I didn't have anyone helping me. I built the cabin alone. I cut all the trees to make the logs. I did all that. And I just would figure out a way to do it and get it done.
Now, by the way, when you were younger, did you have any idea what you would end up doing?
No, but I dreamed about it. You know, as I said before, I would read adventure stories and about gold mining and whatnot, and I guess in the back of my mind I was determined that someday I would do it, and when the time got right, I did.
And by the way, and for anybody who does want to go, the time is still right because you can still do that there. Very few places can you do that and live that kind of a life, but if you want to do it, you can do it still. There's a place to go. And I think, you know, in the cities, you know, Anchorage is, you know, very modern now. Fairbanks is kind of sort of, it's there. But that's not what Alaska is about. There's a tremendous amount of villages, and there's a lot of open space there. And there's a lot of miles of, you're not going to see anybody or anything but animals.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, that's hard to find. Now, what's it like for you now living back in quote-unquote civilization?
Well, I miss the things that I did up there, and I don't like the hustle and bustle that we live around nowadays in town. But I've had it, and I've had experienced this rural life, and I just think it was great.
Now, by the way, what was your greatest lessons, the greatest lessons that you learned out there? If there was one or two that you could give to somebody, what would they be?
Well, I would say that one of the things that kept me going was whatever I did or whatever I attempted, I had a mindset to do it. So my motto from that is that you've got to want to do it. And there's all things in the world that people can do if they set their mind to it and do it. And that's the way I see it.
That's really what it's all about, because when you really come down to it, people are frightened to death to try something new, something different, something that they're not used to or accustomed to. And you just hit it. If you decide that you want to do it, you put your mind to it, there isn't anything that anybody can't accomplish. And I really believe that fear, and everybody gets afraid of something. I mean, there's nobody who's totally fearless, but it's that fear that stops people from moving forward, doing things that they want to do. And when the end of life comes around and they look back and they didn't do any of it, it's too late. And it's called get out there and do it now.
Well, that's true. And I'll tell you, too, also for the benefit of any of your listeners that might be disabled, I was discharged from the Marine Corps 100% disabled, and I just overcome it. And I did all this in spite of that. And I would just like to encourage people that they can do it. Even if you're hampered because of some injury, you might lose a limb or an arm or leg, you still can do it.
Yeah, and that's a message I think we should give to the kids today. You know, you and I come from a world, I mean, you were on the planet before I was, but you and I come from a world that if you had to do something, you could do it. If you got knocked down, you got back up and you kept trying until, you know, one way or the other, you were either down for good or you kept moving with it. And I think that's a lesson that a tremendous amount of these kids today should really learn. There are times that you can't depend on somebody and you got to do it yourself. And that in and of itself, I think, is one of the greatest lessons in the world. And then it's also okay to do it that way.
That's exactly right, and I would encourage everybody just to keep that in mind. You can do it.
No, absolutely. Now, we're starting to run out of time. One more time, please, with your website, and how do we find the book?
Okay, you can get it at Amazon or my website, which is Yukon. That's like the Yukon Territory, yukonyates.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Walter Yates, I want to thank you so much for joining us. What a great story. I got the book. It's an absolute and a total keeper. And by the way, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Take care. Good night.
Bye.
Some of these days you'll feel so lonely. You're going to miss my hugging. You miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby. When I'm gone away, you're gonna feel lonely and want me only. 'Cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you know, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. Yeah, I'm gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so good. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. My hugging, you're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only. 'Cause you know, lover, you always had your way. If you need me, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're missing your brown-eyed daddy. Grab it now, some of these days.
The big question for the night, are your thoughts killing you? In many cases, I'm sure they are. This is about how the science of thinking affects your health and your longevity. And it's not about the secret. This is cutting-edge brain research has proven that thoughts actually change our brains physically and have measurable consequences. Our guest, Dr. Sean Sullivan, explains, and he will explain, to see and hear how our thoughts change thinking and improve our life. He's educated at Harvard University. He's got a private clinical psychology practice. He speaks for ESPN, guides people in mind master journeys worldwide. And his process includes the book, the e-book, The Mind Master Silent Journey. And let us say, Sean, hi, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much, Michael Ray. It's great to be here. I appreciate being here. It's I love talking about this stuff. This is the most important information I've ever come across. So it's a pleasure to be talking to you. Thanks for having me.
And by the way, thank you for being here. I think it's critical enough where people really are starting to become aware of how your brain affects everything. The chemistry in your brain, based on what's released, it has an effect on your body, your mind, your emotions, and the rest of it. And it boils down to this. It's the ability to be intentional. And when I say control, it's an interesting word, but be intentional about what goes on in your life and how you respond to things. We walk into a room, we see somebody we don't like, and all we get that feeling, right? Brain chemicals released. You walk into a room, you got a good feeling, another kind of brain chemicals released, an endorphin or something, and our brains, our minds cause it, everything we do.
There is no doubt about it, and you really hit on the fundamental reason why I do what I do. I just give you a little bit of background. Over the last 10 years, I've spent a lot of time creating a system to address exactly the issue that you're talking about. Because the reality is that we need to have a process in our life. We need to embed something in our lifestyle that shows us step by step how to apply this cutting-edge brain science that you're referring to and that everyone has a decent sense of now, but how to apply it really specifically to your own life to create the brain that you want to have so you can create the life that you want to have. And so that's what I've done with this Mind Master system. It's really based on 21st century Nobel Prize winning brain science breakthroughs, right? And these are, I mean, this is different stuff because the world's top scientists have, they can now show us exactly how our brain operates to produce our life. And it's hard stuff to hear for the first time if you haven't been exposed to it before. But the best brain scientists of our time are calling the breakthroughs that, you know, I share throughout this Mind Master process the most important change in the understanding of the human brain in 400 years. In 400 years, as you know, that's an eternity in the history of science.
No, absolutely.
I'm happy to share more with you about that, but that's just a little bit of background.
Sean, I think when you really come down to it, it works this way. You look at somebody, you get a good feeling, and you say, I love you to them. And if they've had a bad experience with relationships and love, they're going to get a shot of adrenaline, the relationship's over, they're going to run before they get hit. You say, I love you to somebody, and they've had good experience, you get a shot of dopamine, and all of a sudden everything's together and you're connecting. On a level of just two people talking, what you're saying and what you're teaching is so critically important because if you begin to understand that, you can move beyond the bad feelings you get by just hearing words or seeing somebody.
And there is no doubt. And one of the takeaways from this recent research is that there's a lot going on. I think that's what you're referring to, that we don't know.
Sure.
I mean, physiology comes up. We have the expression of it in our lives, but we don't know the thoughts underneath it. We don't know the imagination that we're having that's producing it. And as you said, a lot of times, almost all the time, it's based on our history. It's based on what's gone on in our past. So until we get a system in place that allows us to recognize what's producing the reactions that we're having, then they're going to just repeat. That's the way that our brain works. The more it repeats, the more it repeats, right?
Sure. Now, by the way, the Mind Master
process. Please go ahead.
Oh, okay. I was going to say the Mind Master process in and of itself. Where did you discover it? And when I say discover it, obviously we've had neurosciences around for a long time, and we're getting more and more adept in how to use it and how we respond. But then again, too, you've got a unique slant with this that allows people to actually put it to practical use. So how did you create the program?
Well, let me give you a good analogy that I tell people to explain the
the way of thinking that brought me to really understanding how to apply this brain science, because that's what we're talking about. You know, brain science has just been around for a while, and we're understanding it. But how do you make use of it in your own life is what this Mind Master process is about. And what I tell people to explain the scope of the changes that we've seen is that if you're old enough, you'll remember maybe seeing our rotating Earth from the first images when we saw it from pictures from outer space beamed home to our TV screens for the first time. Do you remember that moment?
Oh, I don't want to admit to it, but yes.
Well, I remember it. You know, the world, when the world is presented in a new way like that, we saw our Earth surrounded for the first time by the vastness of eternity. And we may not have immediately realized it, but something changes in you when you see a new image for the first time, because there's no unseeing it. It leaves a permanent impression on the cells of your brain. And so if we think about, you know, our relationship to the Earth over time, over the centuries, we thought it was flat, and then we knew it was this rotating oblong, and then we saw this picture of it afloat in infinite space among, you know, countless floating rocks, and we see it hovering for the first time, and it hits you in the gut, because it sets this process in motion inside you, and then your worldview, the beliefs that you have about your world need to accommodate. They need to change to account for the new images that your eyes saw. And so in a very much a similar way, now that we've been able to watch the human brain in live action, because we have the technology that allows us to look inside people's minds and see it while it's working, in just the same way that we saw those pictures of the planet Earth, in those images captured from space, we've now been able to see inside our brains functioning in real time, and in very much the same way, these new pictures of the human mind are changing our understanding of ourselves. They're revealing to us how we become, who each become throughout our life. And that's what the Mind Master journey does. It passes along a very precise understanding of how your mind works to produce your life. Yeah, as you mentioned, I think at the top, my background is as a big brain scientist, and you asked, you know, how I came across this. I've been working on peak performance psychology for a long time, and I've been working with people, you know, people like you, through the Mind Master process. And as I understood the brain science and applied it more and more frequently over the years, I developed this process that began to work really effectively with my patients. That I put it out as a book and as an iTunes app, and it went to the top 10 in iTunes books within 3 days of its launch. And I realized all of a sudden that I was able to distill those core principles that I was working with, and that we have learned in this sort of very kind of confusing and murky brain science, but presented it in a way that people can really apply it to their own lives.
You know, an interesting point in psychology, and one of your talking points, I think this is interesting, that what's going to happen to psychology in and of itself, the future of, because in the old days, and I've never been on the opposite side, I've never had to sit down with somebody and get psychological help, but I know many, many people who have, and in the old days, they would sit you down and you would start with your, you know, as a childhood and whatever the problems were. This seems like it cuts right through all of that. As opposed to letting things go, it would get neutral and it wouldn't affect you the way it would, because you'd know how to control your brain chemistry, which would allow you to feel or not feel certain ways. So it seems as though if people use the method that you're talking about, which I think is great, psychology in and of itself, those people practicing it may be out of business.
Well, it's interesting. I think that, yeah, I hear what you're saying. I think that it's changed quite a bit. You know, I get calls from top athletes in the world who are interested in taking their game to a new level, or great artists that want to think in a different way. So it's not always about somebody that's having difficulty when they come see me, although that is a big part of the work that I do also. But what we're quickly learning, since we're quickly learning so much about how the brain works, we're able to be more and more strategic about how to make it work for us. And so, yes, I agree with you. In some cases, that means, you know, we're not going back to early childhood and working our way forward. Instead, maybe we're recognizing what are the patterns that are coming up that are stopping us from being able to pursue our life. And we're just getting really good at listening as those patterns emerge, and we're putting processes in place that change them with immediacy and urgency. Because we can now recognize, and this is
my passion. I'm really excited about the future of psychology because we're learning really how we can use our minds to retool our bodies and retool our emotional lives. And as hard as, to me, as hard as it may be to imagine, I think what we're, where we're headed here is being able to learn to use our minds to intentionally activate our genes so that we could really get great at producing the outcomes that we want in the world.
And I think the key word here, Sean, is intentional. You know, life is not accidental, and it doesn't have to be. If you're intentional with what you do, the end result, the result and effect always comes out the way you want it. But you've got to know what you want before you start. And if you have the tools to do so, then life becomes very different.
Yeah, I really do agree with that. I was even listening to something earlier today, and it gave a statistic. It was that 2% of people, roughly, will actually apply a system, even if they believe that it works, to make their life better. Only 2% of people take it away and actually apply it. And so, yeah, in terms of being intentional, that just knowing facts doesn't necessarily in and of itself change your life. It really means
applying
those facts to your life.
Yeah, you know, you're right. It's applying it. Somebody once said to me, was it that what's the word? I'll call you at 4 o'clock in the morning when I remember what I was going to say. It's the difference between information. You know, the information in and of itself is okay, but it doesn't get you anywhere. It's the application of that information that's going to make it happen. And there are also too many people, which is very interesting, who are frightened to death to use the information because they're afraid to change. You know, better unhappy than unsure, and I'm sure you know a lot of people like that. So you're right. There's a couple of percent of people who actually use it and do it. The others may know how to do it, but they're frightened to death because they don't know what it'll be like to be happy, to be in love, to then the list goes on.
Yeah, I think you're right in that. I've worked very hard to try to address that by putting a process together that if you can sit down and stick with it, one of the things that's meant to do is build habits in your life so that these pieces of the puzzle become second nature to you. So it's not like you're feeling like you're going out of your way to change your life. It's that they become embedded. And, you know, what I'm seeing out there as I go around doing this sort of work is that it becomes really convincing to people that they can change their life and get the things that they want out of their life, produce the change that they want in their life when they see other people that are doing it.
Yeah.
And I think one of the real values of this new brain science that's been produced by these great scientists is that because it works, more and more people are applying it, and then more and more people are saying, hey, this stuff does work. Maybe I should give it a second look because it can benefit me. It's not just somebody, you know, spouting hot air.
Yeah. No. And by the way, I just remembered the word I was going to use: knowledge. It, you know, knowledge in and of itself doesn't get you anywhere. You stay stagnant. Again, it's the application of doing so, but you have to have the want to do so. Too many people run their lives based on what somebody else's opinion may be, and it's very hard to get somebody to turn around and say, "It's your life. You run it the way you run it, and perfection is going to be your definition, not somebody else's." And that's very frightening to a lot of people.
It is. It is. And, you know, these habits get ingrained. And as you said, if we spend too much, you know, one of the things I talk about in the first day of this My Master Journey is that if you spend 2 years in a depressed mindset, then you're going to be a depressed person. You've created a brain that is a depressed brain. And I don't mean to say that in a way to blame a person who's depressed. It's just I'm explaining the physiology of how the brain works. If you're anxious for 2 years straight, then you have an anxious brain. So we can actually look at the brain under these fMRI machines and see the difference in the neurochemistry of the brain. One is an anxious brain, and the other one is a not anxious brain. And so, yeah, it's you know, what you're doing is producing your life, and so the habits become very habit-forming. And after doing it for a while, it becomes hard to imagine what not being that way is. And so,
sure.
You know, that's what I'm passionate about is getting people to maybe in some cases remember the beauty and joy that they could bring into their life in the ability to live dreams that they might have once had and may have, you know, given up on.
Yeah, and it's as simple as this. You run into a very uncomfortable situation force yourself to laugh. And if you can get some laughter out, the laughter creates the endorphins, you know, the feel-good chemicals, the mood enhancers, automatically. And so, in essence, if you can get yourself to laugh, it changes the mood. You change the mood. You change the entire circumstance.
Yeah, you get yourself in the right state. That reminds me of the fake it till you make it approach to things.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's completely true. You take action. You know, my process is pretty specific, but I do hear what you're saying. When you take an action, it produces change inside your body that is going to then produce your next action. And if it's a smile and that's, you know, releasing chemicals inside you that gives you the feeling of satisfaction, then the next thing that you're likely to do is much more likely to be constructive than another negative thought. I love that strategy. Actually, one very practical strategy that I share with people that I think resonates a lot, I get a lot of positive feedback on this one, is that if you can begin to try to recognize the first thought that you have when you're waking up in the morning, and sometimes it's even before you've opened your eyes, and just notice that, because in all likelihood, you've been having that same thought or something like it for a while. And when you begin to notice your first thought of the day and you recognize that each thought you have, the following thought is likely to be similar, and these thoughts combine to produce your moods, right? And so if you start at the beginning of your day and make a shift, and I'm not even going to tell you to change your thought. I'm going to say try to observe what it is. Because that will begin to give you information about what's going on inside your mind that you may not have been aware of before.
No, and by the way, I hear you loud and clear. I think this is phenomenal. Sean, we're running out of time. Do you have a website where we can find you, find the program?
Oh, yeah, of course. Anytime you want to stop by, I'm at themindmaster.com, themindmaster.com, and right on the homepage there, you can sign up and join for a free mini journey that will take you through the process in a miniature way, and you can check out the books and the courses and the applications. I welcome everyone. I would love to get more people involved. We've been growing a lot lately.
Wonderful. Hey, Sean, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I think you're spot on with what you're doing. More and more people should listen to you.
Thank you so much, Michael Ray. It was great to talk to you.
Great. Take care. Good night.
Bye-bye.
And the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime. And a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all.
I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. And let's get into it. Let's get into a balanced life. And so many people just don't know how to achieve it. And our guest, Anis Blimor, is with us. He is the author of A Balanced Life, How to Achieve Success in Every Area of Your Life. He's a successful American entrepreneur of Haitian origin, who came to the United States at 19 years old to achieve the American dream. He holds an MBA with concentration in accounting and has helped so many people achieve their American dreams through his teaching and his coaching. Anis, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Mike. This is Anis Blumer again.
Did I pronounce your name right? Did I do that?
Yes, Anis. Anis Blumer. You got it.
I got it. Okay. Thank you so much for being here. By the way, when we talk about a balanced life, there are so many people just off center. They try. It's like with you. You were doing great. You were doing tax returns, and you were doing everything successful, and all of a sudden, you lost the whole thing. Now, you came back, and the most important thing about coming back were the lessons that you had to learn. And most of the people who are teaching people balance, et cetera, it's academic. But you came from a place where you learned, quote unquote, the hard way. And I think that's the most important lesson that anybody can have. So if I want a balanced life, what's my first step?
Well, definitely you have to use what you already have. For example, if you are you went through education, if you've lost your money, you've lost everything you had, like what happened to me, I started with education. I started again. I went back and opened a business using the knowledge I have in tax preparing taxes, and I went back to school, did my master's, and there are more than one thing in life. That's one thing I realized when I used the watch that I took as an example in a book. I say not only education is important to balance life, but also the spiritual is good. Spirituality can be helpful. Also, I say or emotion can be helpful. Some people are not educated at all. However, the love that they have in their heart, the way they embrace their family or friends, that can help them rebalance life.
Yeah, and by the way, balance is very important. You know, and look at a lot of these kids today, the young singers, the actresses, who was it that just passed? Whitney Houston had everything you could possibly want, money, fame, looks, all of it. But there had to be something missing in her life because she ended it. No matter what anybody says, she ended it. And we look at it and we say, okay, how could you do that with all of these things you have? It's very easy. There are things that we didn't see.
That's correct. And most of the time, when the emotion takes over, you really don't see the other parts of your life within the 24 hours that you have. For example, I had other people in the not only when the emotion is weak. You can have where the money is weak also, where people win the lottery and all the money is gone. For her, in her situation, for example, it was all about the emotion. Life, there was a weakness for me when I judged, when I looked at Whitney, she was missing something, but not in the emotional side. It was really more than something else that she couldn't grasp. And that's why I coach other people. I looked at their lives. I send them notes and say, listen, there might be something that we need to talk about. Yes, you have the money. Yes, you have the fame. Yes, you have but the success itself, being successful, there might be something that's missing. It could be more, most of the time, the spirituality was probably weak on the side, but maybe not. Or maybe the money, she didn't know how to control it. There was a time she was broke. Or it was apparently, there was something missing. But unfortunately, I didn't have time to talk to her about her balanced life.
But I think one of the things that would be missing with her was something called choice. And it's people get in trouble for not what you know, it's what you don't know, you don't know. And that's what takes people like you to, quote unquote, look over their shoulders, have them see their life with a different set of eyes. Because there's a tremendous amount of choices that we do have, but most of the time we are not aware of those choices.
And that's one thing I mentioned in the book also. I wish everybody could read it. I said life itself is about choices, okay? Then the choices that you make will determine the future. And I always put emphasis on those choices, especially as you're growing older. There might be some choices that you have made in the past that will haunt you. And that's why I tell people it's not too late. keep focusing on those four elements of life, which is education, spiritual, emotion, and economy. And I mentioned that if you look at your watch now, you will see you have 24 hours in it. But those 24 hours there, I say those four elements, if you keep it in mind, they will help you balance life daily, weekly, yearly, and forever.
Yeah, and by the way, you have to be able to choose to balance your life. There are so many people out there that if they stay off balance, if they have a problem, that's the only way they've known how to get attention. So it's really a complete shift in the way you look at your life and the relationship of your own life to all those people around you.
That's true. And one other thing I mentioned, keep it simple. I said keep it simple. There are many books about balanced life. They talk about mostly nutrition. They talk about spirituality only, or more than 5, 10, 11 elements for you to keep balancing. But I say to them, to anybody else listening to me, I say no more. Only 4 elements. If you read the book, it's only a 136-page book, you see. All you have to concentrate on or focus on are those four elements. As a matter of fact, even when you make choices in life, I gave an example, probably in one of my seminars I did, I mentioned how someone would purchase a house. Okay, I can do it quickly if we have time. For you to purchase a house, you have to make a decision. Let's, for example, take it as example, a couple. A couple would go and say, honey, let's go and look at the property. You go and look at the property. The first thing is, honey, I love this property. For you to even think about it, one of you has to love the property. Now, I love it. Now, that's the emotion part. Then when you go home, honey, let's buy it, sign a contract. Honey would say, no. Let's sleep over it. For me, that's the spirituality. You take time before you make a decision. Then the third one is, honey, can we sign a contract? Okay, baby, you know, I love it. We're going to take it. Now, yes, we have the money. Do you have the money to put the contract? That's the third one. And the fourth and last one is, was it worth it? Is it worth it? Is it worth it? Is it worth it? Means you have to have the knowledge or get somebody to see if this house has termite, if it has something that's good or bad in it, and that's it. Once you have those four elements, you're going to make a decision. You're going to make a choice. And in life, that is an example because I'm a realtor also by trade. So, but there are many things in life. The way you choose your spouse, your mate, the way you purchase things should be just like that in life.
But the other side of that too, and I'm with you with that. So you never get an argument out of me of anything that you've said. We sit in the same place that way. But the other thing, right, when making a decision, there are, better yet, you're in the real estate business. When people buy a house, they never buy a house. They buy what that house represents to them, what it's going to do for them, how they're going to feel about it after they get it. And I really believe that's part of it in life also, that if they look at something, most people don't make a decision or don't sit down and define what it is that they really want out of whatever it is that they're going to buy. And if you know ahead of time what you want out of that, whatever it is, if you know ahead of time, then you're satisfied with the end result. If you don't know ahead of time and you just get into it, that's, I think, when the problems really start. And the balance, and I think it comes from, you've got triumph emotionally, spiritually, and financially. I think it comes down to that inside of you, that spiritual side of you, and it doesn't matter what religion, faith, whatever it is that you are.
No,
there's that essence of who. It's that essence of who you are that drives you to be and do and experience your life.
That's right. That's right. You dwell.
And this is what most people don't know what to do. That's why we need people like you. We need the coaches. We need the people who look over our shoulders and say, well, that's all well and good, but let's maybe look at it this way. And that this way is maybe a way that somebody else have never looked at it.
That's correct. Well, that's true too. And one of the things is I encourage everyone to at least look at the balance, the lives, and the watch that they're wearing. As said in the book, it's no longer for you. What time it is for you to go and do a purchase or go to work, but it's mostly a new watch that I'm providing to you. When you look at it, you're going to see whether your life is balanced, economic, financially, spiritually, or emotionally. It is very important to look at this. And pretty soon, Mike, I will come up with that touch. I've already gone the path for it. It's very nice, you know, something especially for kids to wear where it says, not my generation. That means, you know, we're going to be balanced. The generation that's coming will not make the mistake this generation and the last generation have made. So it is important for you to read the book and see how you can be part of this group going for balanced life.
Okay, now to put it practically, let's say I'm not balanced. What's my first step? What's the first step when I put my foot on the path of the balance? What's the first thing I look at?
Well, the first thing is identify where your weaknesses are. If you have a weakness, you need to know where they are. If it's any weakness in life can be determined from one of those elements. So once you find it, can it be balanced? Can you help that element? Okay, for example, let's say I'm weak economically. Every piece of dollar I have, or every dollar I have has to be spent. I don't know how to control it. Or on the other side, some people, they have money, they just don't want to spend it. They're really stingy. Those are things you need to control. So for you to go ahead and get control over this, to balance that element, you need to get out of that mentality of not spending or spending and look at the other elements. For example, you have to say, you know what, I have to start giving. And giving is really part of the emotion, part of love. So that giving will help you control, because you're not going to give away everything you have. But on the contrary, you have to start controlling and make notes of how much you have and what's the percentage you're going to start giving away. And you and keeping that same thing in mind, let's say, I don't know how to balance. I have a lot of money my parents left for me. But I keep spending it. You know what you say? You know what? Listen, instead of giving it away, let me go back to school. Let me invest in my education. That part of this can help you balance. So that's how you start. Looking at what you have, what you need, and then start using it to balance that element, whether it's economy or balance something else, or the education, for example. So you have to know where to start, with what's in your hand, what you have, what's your weakness, and then rebalance it to get more strength on that element.
Now, by the way, as a professional tax preparer, when you sit down with someone, if you use the process you just talked about, then that's the smooth path to get through the IRS. It's all the same thing.
As a matter of fact, that was one of my inspirations. You know, one of the things that inspired me, those are my clients. I give them a lot of credits when I was writing the book. What happened is most of my clients, they come here to get more money. They need more. I want a big refund, you know, because I do, my target market is middle class and low income. So when they come, they need a lot of refund. So I talk to them. I show them the page one, page two of the form 1040, and I do some kind of analysis with them and showing them, okay, this year we work here. This is how much you made. This is how much you paid in taxes. Hey, you can get that in refund, but if you do it, this is what will happen. So I look at the element one. I say, look, I know you want more money, but here's what may happen to you. You may be audited later. Or I can say, look, if you spend this and that next time, this is what we'll do. If you pay taxes this month or more this month, this is what we'll get to you at the end. So I do use a balanced life system to help my clients get more refund or less refund, but they understand the process of taxation. When they leave here, they leave it as a balanced person.
Okay, but do they understand the process of taxation or the process of balance applied to taxation?
That's correct.
Yeah. that's where it comes out. Okay, I got it loud and clear. Now, we're starting to run out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes, Anis. A-N-I-S, Blemur, B-L-E-M-U-R .com, AniseBlemur.com. Of course, you can see it's being sold everywhere, but you can find me at AniseBlemur.com. You can contact me there. You can do a review of the book after you purchase it. You can purchase the book there, AniseBlemur.com.
Wonderful. Anise, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time and the work that you do.
Thank you, Mike.
Take care. Good night.
Hello, young lovers, whoever you are. I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own. Once upon a time, a girl with moonlight in her eyes put her hand in mine and said she loved me so. But that was once upon a time, very long ago. Once upon a time, we sat beneath a willow tree, counting all the stars and waiting for the dawn. But that was once upon a time. Now the tree is gone. How the breeze ruffled through her hair. How we always laughed as though tomorrow wasn't there. We were young and didn't have a care. Where did it go? Once upon a time, the world was sweeter than we knew. Everything was
up. Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Call us toll-free. Join us 1-888-429-5471. That's 888-429-5471. Antioxidants and all-natural supplements can kill you. Dr. Ganik Malakian is a chemistry professor at the California State University at Northridge, nationally and internationally recognized expert in the field of radical chemistry. He's trained a generation of professionals and is focused on protecting society from harmful chemicals and environmental pollutants. He's the author of the new Guilty Until Proven Innocent, Antioxidants, Food Supplements, and Cosmetics, a USA Book News Best Award finalist. And let us say, Gagik, welcome to the show.
Oh, hi, Michael.
Hi, did I pronounce your first name right?
Yes, absolutely, Gagik.
Oh, good. Okay, I just want to make sure we got off on a good start. Gagik, let me ask you this. I've been very careful with what I've eaten for years and years and years, and then I'm looking at this and saying all natural supplements can kill you. There's so much information out there that is just so totally confusing, it gets to a point you don't know what's good or what's not good anymore. In your research, when you got into, let's say, all natural supplements, are they truly not safe?
I agree with you, Michael. The information which is available to the general public, it's incredible by volume, and the average person obviously cannot understand and cannot just sort out, because most of the people don't have any significant scientific background. It's difficult even for the professionals working in the field sometimes to sort things out. Now, I strongly criticize the concept of natural in my book, and this is the reason. The general public is very much brainwashed about the very concept of naturalness, to the extent that they think that every natural compound is inherently benign and beneficial for humans. In fact, whatever is coming from either from minerals or from plant kingdom or from animal kingdom is not inherently benign to the human body, more than any other compound, synthetic compound, which is synthesized in the laboratory.
Okay,
now,
are you? Oh, no, go ahead.
Yes, Michael.
Go ahead.
And the main paradigm today in antioxidant science, and I'm criticizing the concept or the class of antioxidants which are called polyphenols. The vitamin E, which is a phenolic compound, is used as a model compound, which is an antioxidant in standard tests. And after that, any other phenolic compound which is extracted from plants, and in fact plants are loaded with phenolic compounds, they all give, in most of the tests, because of the very nature, they give the positive results exactly the same way as vitamin E. And because of this, and only based on this, they are recommending these natural compounds or mixtures of compounds, because extracts are not usually the individual compounds, recommending to the general public as antioxidants.
Okay, but when we look at this, let me hold you up for a minute. All right, so are you saying that the vitamin E in and of itself is better than the phenylethyl? I'm probably pronouncing it wrong. Which is the best to take? And have we been hyped about vitamin E? Is vitamin E as important to take supplementally as we've been told?
First of all, vitamin E. Well, first of all, we should be careful with vitamin E also, because it is by one of the latest publications, the vitamin E has been used on 35,000 men to see if a 400 international units of vitamin E taken over a long period of time can decrease the incidence of prostate cancer. And all of a sudden, for reasons which are not even understood by the researchers, there was a spike in prostate cancer by 17%. This once again emphasizes that if something is called vitamin, we still should not overload our body with these compounds. Now, going back to the vitamin and polyphenolic compounds, vitamin E is very cleverly designed that it doesn't undergo one certain type of reactions which is known to convert phenolic compounds into known carcinogens. I don't want to become too technical to use too many terms. And many of the phenolic compounds which don't have the same structure as vitamin E are susceptible to that very dangerous oxidation in certain positions, which can convert them into carcinogenic derivatives. This is absolutely the same process, which converts female hormone into the known carcinogens.
Okay, Gagik, let me ask you this. Let me hold you up, because I think it's a very important the issue to address. That now, we know that obviously the food that hits our tables, by the time it gets to our table, most of the vitamins, the minerals, all of those things that are healthy for us, they're gone by the time they get there. And then if you digest, your digestion may not be the greatest, and that dilutes it also. So that's when supplementation has come about. What do we do to make sure that our body is getting the proper amount of nutrients so we can function? So there's got to be that something in addition to the food we eat, because the food we eat doesn't, in general, give it to us.
supplementation is important if we know that there is a deficiency inside the body. For example, vitamin D can be easily analyzed in blood, and if it is lower than it's supposed to be, then of course it's advisable for everybody to start taking vitamin D supplements, and after a while, let's say 3 months or 6 months down the road, to measure vitamin D again to see if now it is within the norm or not. So this is a controlled process when we know that there is a deficiency and we're trying to avoid that, right, or to bring up the level of vitamin D, because incredibly important for the human body. What is happening with phenolic compounds, we are extracting the mixture of phenolic compounds from plant, because plant always is a mixture. Most of the structures are not known. The only thing which is known because of this test, that they are antioxidant because they are phenolic. Nothing is known about intimate details of the structure. Mostly unknown number of the compounds, or what is the exact composition, is not known. I'm not even getting into the more intimate details when there are different type of stereoisomers, etc. Each of them can have different biological activity. Nothing is known about the metabolites, what is happening to this. Can be 50 or 100 compounds in extract, and they are advertised as natural supplements. When the long-term consequences, when what is happening inside the body is not known. And this is not easy to know, because it takes very significant resources even to find out what is happening to a single compound inside the body. For example, compounds like tamoxifen, which is one of the main therapeutic means to treat breast cancer, is known to convert into several different metabolites. And you can imagine that if we consume a mixture of natural compounds, phenolic or others, let's say 50 of them, they can become another several hundred compounds inside the body. I'm criticizing this approach that in 21st century, we cannot recommend the general public to take a mixture of compounds of mostly unknown structure, unknown metabolism, unknown long-term consequences, because they are called phenolic, because they are called natural.
Okay, Gagek, but we run into a problem that obviously, you know, one size does not fit all. And because of that, when we order things, we, you know, and we get supplements, we get this, we get that, we can't take blood tests every time that we, you know, every month to make sure that we're getting the proper amounts of the particular vitamins, the supplements, the minerals. How does the average person go through life and not have to worry about everything that he or she eats is carcinogenic?
Well, this is a complex question. Of course, my approach is that the deficiency of certain compounds has to be established inside the body because we'll start taking supplements. Because the increased amount of certain compounds, the way I've demonstrated recently with vitamin E, that I just mentioned, that spike in the prostate cancer, can easily happen with any other compound. So we should be careful even with compounds which are called vitamins, even with compounds which are not naturals. For example, talking about natural compounds that public is so much brainwashed about, if we look at the list of the carcinogenic compounds which are compiled by the reputable international body, which is called International Agency for Research on Cancer. So natural compounds are heavily represented in that list of known carcinogens or suspect carcinogens. I will give you an example. 20 years ago, someone would say that asbestos can be carcinogenic to humans. Most probably the scientists would be ridiculed because it is natural. Now everybody knows, because asbestos is almost a household name. What about other compounds? It's a silica, it's a shale oil, it's lead and nickel and some herbal remedies, some aragonauts, aflatoxins. They are known to be carcinogenic compounds. They are already in that list. My concern is that by knowing so much about natural compounds, in 21st century, we're still extracting supplements from plants and recommending people to take it. Unless we know that there is a need for supplementation of specific individual, the keys, individual compounds. No one should take a mixture of compounds hoping that somehow it will prolong their lives. This is like the same as going into the pharmacy, taking the 10 or 15 bottles, extracting, using this content as a cocktail of drugs, and to consume it and to hope that somehow it will act or it will serve some chemopreventive purposes. We don't do this. But at the same time, phenolic compounds, very often, they are known to be drugs. We should be very careful with phenolic compounds. If we look at the structures of the compounds that today are on the market, many of them have the phenolic structure because they are biologically active compounds.
Now, by the way, let me ask you this question. What about a multivitamin? Would that fall into that category that you're talking about?
Well, multivitamin is a good type of supplementation because these are individual vitamins which are combined in the single formulation. Yeah. And these are different groups of vitamins. So this is not something which is extracted from some part of the plant and called natural supplement. So it is a good idea to take, but again, because of the recent fact that even vitamin E can cause the spike in the prostate cancer, we should be careful even with vitamins. It's the main problem with supplementation is it is an uncontrolled use. And doctors sometimes can advise to use the certain amounts per week or per month, but the amounts which are recommended are not really just based on science. Because different bodies have different type of deficiencies. We need to develop the efficient ways to analyze the need for vitamins, and after that we should take them. Because even vitamins can be harmful to the human body.
Okay, so
in excessive amounts.
Yeah, what we're saying, and stop me if I'm wrong, I'm not a clinician, but what you're saying really is, unless you feel off, unless you feel bad, don't take anything. And then when you go to get your diagnosis and the doctor says you're short in this or you need more of that, based on that, those tests, that's when you supplement. Is this what I'm hearing you say?
This will be the common sense, because it is... If the body functions properly, if the people feel healthy, so I don't see really why there is a need for any kind of supplementation. If there is a problem, of course, if people feel tired or there are other issues with cognitive function, et cetera, then, of course, doctors have to decide what is the reason for that, which vitamin is deficient in that particular body, and prescribe that particular vitamin. The consumption of anything in 21st century has to be based on science. This is what I'm advocating for.
Yeah, absolutely. And the one thing that I've learned over the years is that based on what you take, let's say, for instance, a hypothetical, that I have too many white blood cells, you want to give me some B12 to make sure I get more red blood cells. But if that vitamin is not combined with something else, whatever that something else is, instead of going to my blood, it may end up in my skin. So realistically, you can't just go to the store and get a vitamin. You've got to be able to work with somebody who knows the interaction of the different supplements and the vitamins and the end result of the result and effect on your body. And I think that's one of the things that most people don't do. The supplementation industry is, you know, it's hundreds of millions of dollars. And as long as they're making money, they're going to tell you that it's safe and it's good for you.
Right. The issue with the supplementation, in particular with the vitamins, is uncontrollable use. And we should be very careful with this. For example, there are natural compounds which are not only taken from plant, but they are present inside the body. So what can be more natural than compounds which are present inside the body? They are called biogenic. For example, estrogen, which is female hormone, now is known to be carcinogenic compound. There are some even issues with the insulin. Insulin, which is a natural hormone from inside the body, is known to have issues when it is introduced into the body in its inhalable form. Androgen these days, which is a male hormone, also is introduced in that list of the carcinogenic compounds in the group 2A as a suspect carcinogen, which is also a natural compound. So by knowing so much, something that we didn't know even 10 or 15 years ago, we should be very careful with compounds which are coming from plant, compounds which are coming from the plant kingdom, because even compounds which are coming from the human body, taking from one part of the body into other, can cause harm. Or, as in case of estrogen, for example, when it is above certain concentration, and this was the whole issue with the hormone replacement therapy, above certain concentrations, then it can have the detrimental impact, and the breast cancer can be triggered.
Gagik, I wish we could talk about this all night, but we are out of time now. Let me ask you a question. Do you have a website we can find you at and purchase the book?
Absolutely. First of all, the book is available from Amazon. So in Amazon, under books, if you will type guilty until proven innocent, this is one of the first hits which will show up. Or people can go to Google and just type guilty antioxidant, and this is the first hit that they will see on the screen. So in Google, guilty antioxidant, and this is the first hit. And the website is www.csun.edu/G-Melikian. My last name, M-E-L-I-K-Y-A-N. And there is a lot of information. There is a free sample, a sample chapter on natural compounds. And also, I have started the foundation, which is called Alliance of Concerned Citizens, and I'm publishing an online newsletter so that I can reach out to a wide audience and to bring the latest news on health-related issues to thousands of people. And if someone from the audience would like also to get into my distribution list, please send me the email, and I will gladly introduce you into the distribution list. You can easily find me if you go to the internet and just type Gagik Melikian, Cal State University, Northridge, and you will definitely find my email address also.
Wonderful. Gagik, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I've appreciated this. Maybe we'll save some lives out there.
Right. Thank you so much. Thank you for inviting me.
Good night.
Good night.
Your tears and laughter dusty
wall. I'm Michael Ray Dresser.
And I'm Radio Susie.
And that, my friends, is a wrap.
I was made for this. Nothing else would I trade for this. And just think, I get paid.
Good night, ladies and gentlemen.